quite have a quorum, but time's a-wasting. We've got some great people here to talk to us about health care costs, and I want to get to it. So I will officially convene the meeting, and we'll go through approving the minutes and all that when we do have a quorum. Members, the idea about this meeting today, which I think is a particularly important meeting, is to talk about the increasing health care costs that we have in our state. We've all heard the governor talk about how this is a major driver in his budget. We all know from being on the Ways and Means Committee that this is the fastest area that we have, fastest growing area in the state, and I really thought that as we talked about health care and the importance of this area, that a hearing just devoted to why health care costs are going up so much would be really useful. So with that, I do hope to focus on health care costs in general and not so much the governor's budget and what he's recommending or not recommending, but instead just really on the health care area. But as members have questions, of course, please feel free to ask them. And I do have a quorum, so the meeting will officially come to order. Members, we've got the minutes of the February 7th meeting in front of us. Representative McNamara approves approval of the minutes. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the approval of the minutes of February 7th, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. For that, could I have Scott Lights come forward? And Mr. Lights, could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Lights. I direct the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. The Health Economics Program is a program that exists within the State Health Department to provide research and policy analysis on healthcare spending, access, and healthcare cost issues to the legislature and other stakeholders. This afternoon, I'm going to be speaking about a number of things. First off, I'm going to try to give you an overview of healthcare spending in Minnesota, and I'm going to be talking about health spending in the broad context, how much we spend as a state on healthcare, both publicly sponsored and privately sponsored. I'm going to touch a little bit on private sector health spending trends, what some of the drivers of healthcare cost growth are, and then I'll close by talking a little bit about the public sector healthcare spending and putting it in some context to how much we spend in Minnesota relative to other states. Well, certainly the issue of healthcare spending is important both from a fiscal budget perspective as well as an overall perspective because healthcare expenditures have been growing as a portion of our economy. As you can see here, over the course of the past 4 years, as a share of our national economy, healthcare has grown from around 5% in 1960 to over around 15% in 2003. And if you were going to compare numbers for Minnesota, those figures would be very similar if you were to look at our state as well. Healthcare, because it's been growing much faster than overall economic growth, has continued to consume a much larger portion of our economy over time. When we think about healthcare spending, healthcare, while it's a lot more complicated, is also a lot like any other good in some sense. How much we spend on it is really a function of what the price of the good is and the quantity of that good that we consume is. So we can focus, when we examine on issues such as why healthcare costs has grown, we can focus on growth in the cost of that healthcare per unit, that is how fast are the prices of healthcare going up. We can look at the growth in the quantity of care used, how fast is quantity growing, and then we can focus on how services have changed as, for example, prescription drugs have substituted for some surgical procedures or other things, so that where there's been substitution of certain services for other services due to technological growth. Perhaps a useful way to think about healthcare spending is to think about it in levels. Thinking about the top of this chart, the small box that says dollars spent on healthcare, you can think about that being the aggregate amount of healthcare dollars that we spend in nationally or in Minnesota. In Minnesota, we spend around $27 billion annually on healthcare. We can break down how much we spend on healthcare into who pays for healthcare, that is it the individual, is it businesses, and what services are purchased, hospitalizations, drugs, physician visits. We can further break that down into what causes changes in spending for a particular category of service. So it might be the change in the price of hospitalizations. It might be the fact that we're being hospitalized more frequently than we had been, or some change in the mix of those things. And then finally, at the bottom of the chart, where it says factors affecting price and factors affecting quantity of services, there's a whole host of things that affect what the price of healthcare that we consume is and what the quantity of healthcare that we consume is. So there's really two main points I want to take, I want to make about this chart. One is that it's relatively straightforward to know how much we spend on healthcare. We can estimate that fairly readily. But as you go down to the bottom of the chart, you see that the actual factors that influence how much we spend on healthcare are very many and very complicated, and that there isn't just one single thing that's driving healthcare, but rather some constellation of issues, some of which are in the realm of policy control, and policymakers can examine. Other things are outside of the realm of policymaker control, things like genetics and technology to some degree, and demographics. Before I get into how much we spend on healthcare, I just want to put up a chart that gives you some basis of knowledge as to how Minnesotans actually get their health insurance coverage. Most Minnesotans, if you look at the pie chart, the sort of gray pieces on the pie chart indicate private sector sources of health insurance coverage, and most Minnesotans do get their health coverage in the private sector through their employer. About 67% of Minnesotans, or a little over two-thirds, get their coverage through an employer-based system. In the blue is government programs, and that would include programs such as Medicare, which is a program for the elderly, medical assistance, which covers some elderly but also disabled populations and our low-income populations, as well as other government programs, including the General Assistance Medical Care Program, Minnesota Care, and the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. All of those combined to cover about a quarter of our population. And then at any given point in time, about 5.4% of Minnesota's population does not have health insurance coverage.
Representative Wickovina.
Sir, when I'm looking at this graph here, where you have Medicare at 13.3%, most of my senior citizens on Medicare have their supplemental insurance that they pay for as individuals. So is that number included in that individuals at 4%?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, this would be looking at the source of primary payment. So those people would be included under the Medicare box. We wouldn't actually count the Medicare supplemental in this chart, although you're correct that about two-thirds or more of persons enrolled in the Medicare program do have supplemental coverage, which they pay for outside of the Medicare program.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Leitz, is it?
Yes.
Is when you were talking before about the individuals, then, or the $27 million, or $27 billion, is that included in there, the supplemental insurance? And what would that must be a pretty big portion of because we have a senior population, pretty big portion, isn't it?
Mr. Leitz? Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, it is included in that $27 billion. I don't have an exact breakdown. It would be of the total, it would be a relatively small portion. However, we do know that for that particular population, that is the over 65 population, that it is an important piece of their out-of-pocket healthcare expenditures.
And finally, Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz, the Medicare, you've got it up there, but it's really all federal money coming to the state, right?
Mr. Leitz. Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, the Medicare program is a fully federally financed program, that is correct. And I will have a chart in a few moments that will sort of break down our public health care spending and showing what portion of that is federal, and it is a heavily federal a piece of that.
Okay, Representatives Wagenius, Smith, and Gunther. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This chart is a snapshot of 2002, and I don't have a sense of history here. You've got two-thirds of the folks getting insurance from their employer. Is that increasing, decreasing, or has it been stagnant over time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the piece on private coverage has been it tends to increase when economic times are good, and it tends to decline when economic times are not as good. So private health insurance coverage really expands and contracts as the economy expands and contracts. And by and large, when it contracts, it ends up either increasing the uninsured slice or increasing the public program slice of the pie. So When we had strong economic growth in the latter part of the 1990s and in very early 2000, that private piece was expanding fairly rapidly. It has stabilized somewhat, and this goes through 2002, as you noted, which doesn't capture the full effect of some of the slowdown in the economy that also occurred in 2003. So it expanded rapidly in the 90s and has been sort of stagnant since that time.
Representative Wiggins?
If I could just follow up. So you would expect that the 2003 and the 2004 numbers would be less than the 2002 numbers for private health insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we would anticipate that.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Lights, a couple questions on this chart. The last figures I saw indicated that the national average for persons not insured by either public or private health insurance is roughly between 12 and 13% of the population on average. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that is correct. I think the last number that came out of the U.S. Census Bureau, which does the annual tracking, was a little over 14% nationally.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lights, also I think the ranking indicates that I saw that Minnesota is number one in the lowest number of uninsured of its population.
Representative, that is correct. It varies a little bit year to year. This past year we were the lowest, but generally speaking we're among the two or three lowest generally.
Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lights, you mentioned the federal government employees pays for Medicare. I thought employers paid a little of that too. Of course, employers pay everything the federal government has. I understand that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, you are correct. Certainly, the programs that are paid for at the federal level are supported by the general taxation that goes in to support those programs.
I was pretty sure I wrote a check out for that.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Riccovina.
Mr. Chair, to that point, you know, out of that 7.65% that you match, Representative Gunther, I think 1.35, isn't it? Or 1.3 is for, as you said, Medicare. On Bill Gates' entire income. See, we could solve Social Security tomorrow if Bill Gates paid that other 6.35 on his entire income, and we could probably lower our payroll tax to 2% if we did that.
Okay. I've already had a lot of federal issue discussions today. I think we need to get back to the state.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't bring it up.
Mr. Lights, please continue. Oh, I've got Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The figures that Representative Smith was mentioning about where we rank nationally with the number of uninsureds was the same case when we put MinCare in. The figures were one or two at that time. So what effect has MinCare had on reducing the uninsured?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, what you find when you look sort of nationally or state by state, it's those states with relatively strong private health insurance markets tend to have, meaning a lot of the employer coverage or fairly broad coverage in the employer market, tend to be those states with relatively low rates of uninsurance. States by and large enroll approximately to the same portion of people in public health insurance programs. There's some variation around the edges, but by and large what drives private health insurance, lower uninsurance rates tends to be strong private health insurance.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, very quick.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lentz, do you have any data from the Department of Health in both the large employer and the small employer, the changes in health insurance that has been switched from the insurance company paying for my cost to shifting that to the consumer, my co-pays, so forth, and the amount that has. I mean, I can insure everybody in the world if I don't give them any benefits.
Mr. Lights, Mr. Chair, Representative, I will be getting to a little bit of that data in a few minutes, but let me just summarize real briefly. I mean, what we've seen in general in private health insurance is that as a portion of the overall premium, employers are paying have continued to pay approximately the same portion of a worker's premium. But where we have seen fairly substantial changes is in the cost-sharing arrangements that exist on things such as deductibles and co-pays and so on, so that individuals are paying a higher portion of their income out of pocket.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, let's proceed, Mr. Leitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mentioned before that this is as of 2002, we were spending about $23 billion as a state on our overall health care spending. That figure would have grown to around $27 billion by the end of 2004. And this just shows kind of who finances that health care. The blue pieces of the pie are essentially private health insurance sources or private funding sources. That would be things such as private health insurance at around 40% and out-of-pocket payments at 15%. And then in the gray is publicly funded areas of coverage, with the Medicare program funding about 15% of our overall health spending in our state, and medical assistance or the Medicaid program around 19% of our overall health spending. If we take that, so if you add up the gray pieces on here, you wind up with a figure of around 48% of our healthcare spending being privately or publicly financed. If we take that publicly financed piece and break it down by who actually pays from a federal, state, and local perspective, approximately 70 cents out of every public healthcare dollar, and when I say public healthcare, I mean publicly sponsored health insurance programs, is federally financed. Feds pay about 67%, the state about 31%, and localities about 2%. And that's important to recognize because the reason that it adds up so high is that the Medicare program is fully federally financed, and the medical assistance program has a federal matching component. So for every dollar the state puts in, the federal government also matches that with a dollar. And therefore, the federal government plays a large role in our public health insurance spending.
Okay, Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leitz, what percentage of the, maybe we'll go to the second, or just the previous graph, or even this graph here, what percentage of our, if you want to call it medical assistance, in that graph right there that you have, is paid for? Senior citizens, you know, nursing homes and those types of things. And the same with the next one where you have state at 31%. What percentage there is for our seniors and nursing homes? Or let's say those that have been seriously disabled for some reason or on Social Security disability or something. What percentage is there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, in terms of on the medical assistance roles, the spending is disproportionate to enrollment, meaning that the elderly and the disabled and the blind populations on the medical assistance program enroll a relatively small share of that program's population, but actually spend the majority of the dollars in the program. So I believe that medical assistance spending, around 76 to 77% of the spending is for the elderly and disabled populations on that program.
So of all of our public spending in Minnesota that we would consider welfare spending, or point being made, 76% is going to seniors and a few others that are seriously disabled.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I believe the case in the medical assistance program that the spending to be approximately that ratio on the elderly, blind and disabled.
Representative Guineas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at your chart with local spending at 2% in 2002. I'm interested in two things. One, how much that has increased in 2003, how much it increased in 2004, and what's the actual dollar amount? I mean, I assume that by local you mean property tax expenditures. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiggins, yes, that would be it would be spending that's sponsored at the local level, however the funds are raised.
Okay. So it would be important for us to see the trend line here and how much is shifting to property taxes. So if you could, is that all right if we could get those numbers? Because I suspect you don't have them here. To see what we were paying in property taxes in 2002, 2003, and 2004.
And Mr. Leitz, if that's something you could provide to us at a later date, that'd be great.
I'd be happy to do so, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Leitz, a couple of questions on the second figure there. The out-of-pocket, includes people that don't have insurance that are paying their bills, but also does that include the copays and deductibles and so on?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, it does.
Okay, my second question, Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz, is does this figure include long-term care?
Mr. Leitz, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, yes, it does. So it would be essentially captured primarily through the out-of-pocket portion and the medical assistance portions of those of that chart.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a comment on some previous comments. Medicare is fully federal money, but to the degree that they don't pay the full cost of treatment, which is usually what happens, it means that Minnesota citizens or hospitals or whatever are stuck with the excess bill.
Okay, Mr. Leitz, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, the next chart shows essentially the cost per person by the different populations that are enrolled in private health insurance coverage and public programs. And what it demonstrates is that there's a large amount of variability that exists between the various payment sources that exist out there, primarily driven by the types of populations who are enrolled in those various programs. For example, Medicare costs on average about $5,000 per person in terms of payments that come out. Medical assistance are a little over $10,000. And again, that relates to the types of populations. In Medicare, the elderly, in medical assistance, the disabled, those on long-term care. General assistance medical care, the piece labeled GAMC, the fourth one over, oftentimes high-cost hospital care. And then you can note that in private health insurance coverage in Minnesota Care, for example, have similar spending patterns in terms of costs per enrollee because they enroll similar types of populations. Now, you might recall that I showed you earlier that about a quarter of the population in Minnesota is enrolled in a publicly sponsored health insurance program. That would be medical assistance, Minnesota Care, Medicare, general assistance medical care. But that those public health insurance programs actually finance over 40% of our health care spending. And again, it's because of that disproportionate nature of who actually enrolls in the publicly sponsored programs relative to private health insurance coverage. We have higher cost populations in general because of the nature of the elderly and the long-term care and disabled individuals who are on the medical assistance program. And then finally, when we look at where the $20-plus billion that we spend on health care goes, that's what this chart sort of breaks down. What services do we actually purchase for our health care dollars? About half of our health care spending goes for traditional sort of hospital physician services. That's kind of on the right-hand side of the chart, the white and the two blue pieces labeled inpatient and outpatient hospital and physician services. About 16% goes for long-term care. And about 12% of our healthcare dollar goes for prescription drugs. That's been a growing piece of the pie over time as the rate of increase in drug spending has outstripped some of the other pieces, but it still remains a relatively small portion of our overall health spending.
Mr. Leitz, can you give us an example of what are some examples of the other spending category in there? You've got other professional services. I don't know if that's chiropractic or what that is, and just the other category in general, 14% is a pretty big category. What are some examples of that?
Mr. Chairman, it's really made up of a combination of a lot of small things. So some things that might go into would be spending on public health, for example, spending that occurs on for durable medical equipment, spending that would occur for over-the-counter medicines that aren't captured under the prescription category. I believe we broke out dental separately. We did on this, and sometimes that gets rolled up. But those are the types of things. And they're all relatively small, but they sort of add up to a fairly large chunk.
Okay. Thank you.
In terms, just for a few minutes to talk about what's going on in the private sector and in terms of how fast costs are growing. And what I think it demonstrates is that regardless of whether we're looking at the private or public sector, costs are growing relatively rapidly. This first chart shows the rate of increase in private health care costs, that's the red line, compared to other measures of economic output. And what we compare it to in this slide in the yellow is per capita income growth in Minnesota. In the light blue is the average worker wage in Minnesota. And then in the green is just the overall inflation rate in the state of Minnesota. And what it demonstrates is the fact that since 1999, healthcare cost growth has grown much, much more rapidly than any of those other measures on a year-over-year growth basis. So the implication here is that, you know, as you think about workers, a higher portion, for example, of their, since healthcare costs are growing more quickly than wages are, an average worker's wage, more of that would need to be used to cover health insurance costs relative to in the mid-90s.
Excuse me, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Heitz, Mr. Chairman, what was taking place in 95, 96, and 97 that we had a decrease?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, in the mid-1990s was a period of relatively slow healthcare cost growth. There were a number of factors which were combining to hold down healthcare costs. Some of it was attributable to the growth of managed care during that time period. Utilization was somewhat slower during that time period, and healthcare costs both Minnesota and nationally were relatively low during that time period. It was also a period of relatively strong economic growth when incomes and wages were growing fairly rapidly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, look at incomes, and they were not growing really rapidly. It's almost a straight line. We may have been more people employed. That's true. I mean, so in that respect, but not necessarily. But it's just kind of interesting. I know Minnesota was very aggressive in managed care, but we're still aggressive in managed care.
Mr. Leitz? Oh, okay. Comment. Representative Huntley.
Just a comment. Part of that dip, I think, was due a response to some of the things we did in Minnesota Care. On the other hand, every time the federal government starts talking about major health care reform efforts, which President Clinton was doing at that time, for some reason, same thing happened when Nixon was president, so it's bipartisan. When they start talking about big changes in national health care, suddenly spending, or rather costs, go down or are held constant. So it's a response of the providers and insurance companies to kind of put their head down and stay out of sight.
Okay, Mr. Leitz, please continue.
Mr. Chair, there was a question earlier that related to how has the changes that have occurred in employer-based health insurance in terms of cost-sharing affected the cost of coverage for individuals. And that's what this chart, these next two charts, attempt to take a look at. In this first chart, we look at, this is for employer-based health insurance coverage. On the left-hand side of the chart is single coverage, so think about it as an employee enrolling as an individual in his or her employer health insurance coverage. And then on the right-hand side is family coverage. And what both of the slides indicate is that between 1993 and 2002, the proportion of total health insurance premium that's paid for by the employer really hasn't changed. Proportionately, they're the same. It's approximately the same 1993 to 2002, whether we're looking at either single coverage or family coverage. But because of the rapid growth in health insurance premiums, the actual sheer amount that's paid has increased fairly substantially. For example, comparing 1997 to 2002 for family coverage in Minnesota, and concentrating on the individuals portion for a moment, the amount that an individual or an employee had to contribute towards that family coverage increased from, and this is on a monthly basis, increased from $121 a month to, on average, to around $212 a month. And so while the proportion is the same of the employer contributing, sheer growth in premium over that time means that the sheer dollar amount grew fairly substantially over that time period.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lenz, this shows us how much is taken out by each for single coverage and family coverage for premium. Do you have any figures that talk about the level of benefits, how much is out-of-pocket expenses of co-pays?
Mr. Leitz. Mr. Chair, Representative, the next chart here sort of attempts to look at that issue. And this would be how much, if you think about at the point of service, that is when an enrollee in a health plan goes to seek services at a physician or at a hospital or any other provider that they might be seeking services at, it shows that portion of the cost that's paid for by the health plan and then that portion that's paid for by the enrollee. And what you see in the chart is that, for example, if you want to compare 1997 to 2003 as the two sort of extreme points, an individual in 1997 paid approximately $152 out of pocket when they sought services on the average over the course of a year. That figure had grown to around $382 by 2003, so more than a doubling over that time period between those two. And that's really a function of two things. One is a function of the growth in overall healthcare cost over that time period, but it's also a function of the fact that additional costs have been shifted in the past several years onto employees through higher co-pays and higher cost sharing such as deductibles. Finally, Mr. Chairman and members, this chart talks about what some of the drivers are of spending growth in Minnesota. And it takes a look, this is for private health insurance in Minnesota, and it takes a look at the major services that people seek in the healthcare system: prescription drugs, outpatient hospital, inpatient physician, and looks at how fast those pieces are growing, and then how much they contribute to our overall growth. So the blue bar indicates how fast an individual component of healthcare spending is increasing. So drugs, for example, are growing at a rate of approximately 19% annually, year-over-year growth rate. Same for outpatient hospital being around 18%, and so on down the chart. On average, healthcare costs for those for individuals grew at about 13% annually. If we look at what portion of overall spending growth is actually contributed by that share, because physician services, while not growing the fastest, starts off as a relatively big piece of the pie to begin with, its growth at around 12% leads to a situation where it's the largest contributor to overall healthcare cost growth in physician services. Similarly, if you combine the outpatient and inpatient hospital portions, they combine for around 35%, and drugs contribute about 21% to the overall cost growth.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Lights, what's other medical?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, other medical would be any services not included in the pieces that are listed here. So that would be chiropractic care, which has grown fairly rapidly. It could be any allied providers or other providers that are not physicians or hospitalization. One thing that I wanted to put in as a slide, and this is true for both private health insurance and public health insurance, is the fact that healthcare spending broadly, nationally and in Minnesota, is really quite concentrated among a relatively small group of people. The way to interpret this chart is to, starting at the left-hand side, where it says 1% and 27%, basically the most expensive 1% of the population. And that's true of any relatively large group. It's true of the state as a whole, and it's true of any large employer group. That most expensive 1% spends about 27% of the healthcare resources. Very expensive people. The most expensive 5% spends approximately 55% of healthcare resources, and so on across the chart. So you can see that about the most expensive half of the population spends almost all of our healthcare resources, which means in any given year, there's about half the population that really doesn't do any healthcare spending. So it's an important point to keep in mind, especially as you think about where some of the drivers are, both on the private health insurance side and on the Medicaid public health insurance side, the fact that a relatively small portion of fairly chronically ill individuals really drive a lot of the healthcare spending that we do.
Mr. Lights, is it the case that the same 50% pretty much year after year don't have any major healthcare spending, or does that differ a lot? One year someone doesn't have anything, and the other year they've got a lot.
Mr. Chairman, it's a mix of those two. There are cases where individuals chronically are among the sickest individuals and stay in that category over time. But there are also situations where healthy individuals who may not have had any healthcare expenditures in the previous year are in a car accident or have some traumatic event, which does cause them to incur large amounts of medical expenditure, and they would then fall into that category of relatively high cost. They may not stay there for an extended period of time, but they may bounce in there for a short period of time.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any demographics statewide that indicate certain concentrations of healthcare spending?
Geographically, you mean?
Yes. I mean, is the Iron Range spending all of our money up there? Where is this spending out?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, there is a strong correlation, for example, between healthcare expenditures and the aging of a population. So the extent that certain portions of the state are older demographically than other portions of the state, it's likely that those areas of the state have a higher per capita healthcare expenditure simply because of the demographic makeup of that area.
Representative Sakura.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Leitz. Do you also look at other demographic issues such as obesity or heart problems, asthma, smoking, all those kinds of things, to see if those cost drivers are in there?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sakura, certainly they are. The aggregate statistics sort of aggregate all the spending, but then we try to dig down and see what some of the factors are that are driving some of that spending. And issues such as the growth in obesity, in fact, I have a slide in a few minutes here that'll touch on that issue, is a portion of that. As we've seen increases, there have been national studies now that have looked and have shown that the costs of overweight and obesity now rival those of smoking, for example, in terms of the overall healthcare costs that are associated with them. So certainly that is a factor.
Okay, I've got Representative Solberg, and then I think we should let Mr. Leitz continue on with his presentation. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, when I drive down in the metropolitan area, I hear all kinds of ads all the time for people to come in and get their cosmetic surgery, and I'm sure it's really expensive healthcare, and most of those clinics are located in Edina.
We tax those folks. That's how we make our property, keep our property taxes down.
Earhart would look a lot worse if he had cosmetic surgery.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't want to get on there.
I thought I would spend a few minutes just talking about some of the factors that are likely contributing to the growth that we've seen in healthcare costs. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but some of the major things that people, analysts and others, have talked about as being some of the drivers. The first one that I have listed there is technology and investment. One of the things that most economists agree has driven a lot of the healthcare cost growth that we've seen over the past 20 to 30 years has been the rapid advance in technology that we've had. Technology is an issue of a trade-off. We get better outcomes, oftentimes much less invasive procedures that allow for better quality of life over time, but they come at a cost, and the rapid advance of technology and the investment that's gone on there likely has been a contributor to healthcare cost growth. It's likely also had a very positive benefit in many cases, but also has likely contributed to some degree to healthcare cost growth. And similarly, on the investment side, we have invested fairly heavily in new facilities and in new types of equipment as they've come along and they've been made available and have been broadly available for consumers. Consumers have expressed a strong preference for readily easy access to those types of facilities and equipment. Again, an issue of a trade-off, better access to services, but probably at a somewhat higher cost. The second issue Representative Sakura already touched on, which is the issue of lifestyle and behavior. We have, for example, seen a relatively rapid increase over the course of the past decade in the portion of our population who is obese. For example, about a doubling in adults in Minnesota. And while we don't have specific data for children in Minnesota, you can see that nationally we've had a doubling of obesity in kids 6 to 11 and then a tripling in kids 12 to 19. And obesity is associated with a lot of diseases such as diabetes and likely leads to higher healthcare costs down the road. And so as those changes have occurred, they've likely been a cost driver as well. The next issue I have listed is consumer preference for broad healthcare provider networks with few access restrictions. And again, this is another issue of a healthcare trade-off where consumers have fairly strongly expressed a preference for being able to access specialty care fairly readily, being able to access it relatively close to home. And that has likely led to some increase in cost and likely some increase in utilization. Again, there's a trade-off there. It's certainly good from a consumer perspective, being able to meet the consumer's preferences and needs, but likely at some additional cost as we have added additional facilities to meet those needs. The next issue I listed as overuse, underuse, and misuse of healthcare. That's a terminology used by a researcher by the name of Mark Chaslin. But essentially what's been pointed out in the literature is that there's really widespread evidence of overuse, underuse, and misuse of healthcare services, which likely leads to some misalignment of health care in the system. Just a few examples. We know that, for example, Medicare spending in high-spending areas of the country is up to 60% higher than in lower-spending areas, such as Minnesota, with no differences in quality of care, access to care, survival, or health outcomes. It simply is additional care that's in the system that doesn't seem to produce any additional outcome. We know that from the literature that about half of adults in the U.S. do not get recommended care when they seek health care. And there's been a whole series of work that's been done looking at the issue of medical errors and adverse health events that actually have disadvantageous outcomes for patients but cost money as well.
And Mr. Leitz, when you look at the first issue of Medicare you talked about and the 60% figure, is it a case that people are actually utilizing 60% more care, or does everything in those other states cost 60% more?
Mr. Chairman, by and large, that's driven by utilization patterns. Those people are actually using more care. And when you look at some of the work that's been done nationally, the variation that exists between what we know from, for example, the variation that exists in certain areas, for certain geographic areas of the country, in terms of utilization of types of services, can vary quite dramatically from other areas of the country. So it's really a utilization-driven phenomenon.
Representative Rukavina.
I don't understand this chart here, Mr. Leitz. What you're saying, in follow-up to Congressman Knobloch's question, is are you saying that because of the federal formula for Medicare reimbursement that it's a high spend? Is that what qualifies it as a high spend area? Because Florida gets the I think our congressional district and the 8th congressional district of Minnesota, isn't it? Representative Huntley, help me out here, like the third lowest reimbursement congressional district in the United States of America. So is that what you're talking about here?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, part of that is the rates that get paid to Minnesota, which are relatively low. The majority of it, however, is really related to the utilization patterns of Medicare beneficiaries who are actually enrolled in Medicare. And much of that is driven by referral patterns of individual physicians and hospitals in other parts of the country.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
and again, I'm no expert in this area, Mr. Huntley or Mr. Bradley is, but the fact that didn't we in Minnesota start off with the HMOs? It was kind of a unique idea in this state, so doesn't that have something, it also has something to do with our reimbursement rate, because that's when they were setting these reimbursement rates federally. But it probably also has something to do with what you're talking about in this graph then, right? Because we have this long history in this state of these HMO-type referral-type programs, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, Minnesota has traditionally had relatively lower levels of this variation that exists in terms of referral patterns that exist in other parts of the country, and part of that is likely due to the environment through which health care came to be delivered in Minnesota relative to other parts of the country.
Which gets me to my final point, Mr. Chair. I still don't know what the point of this one is.
Well, we'll just keep listening and learning, Representative Rukavina. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, if I just give you an example, it might help you there, Representative Rukavina. There's a guy from Dartmouth named, I can't remember his first name, his last name is Wenberg, and he's the leading authority on how practice varies across the country. And I heard him talk a couple of years ago, and these numbers are close to it, but not, you know, this is just from memory, but in the last 6 months of life in Minnesota, we see about 1.8 different specialists in the last 6 months of our life. In Florida and Texas, it's like six. So they're just getting more and more treatment, yet there's no difference. In fact, we're probably better in the outcomes here than they are there. So they're just seeing more physicians for more things. They don't do any good. And I'd like to say it's not our HMO background, it's probably our Scandinavian background, but we're just a little more conservative, and when it comes time to end of life, I think we don't try extraordinary things that we know aren't going to work here. Whereas in other parts of the country, either the doctors are demanding it or the patients are demanding it. And it doesn't make any difference, except the price goes up.
Okay, let's keep moving on here. Appreciate those comments. Got a lot of material ahead of us, so Mr. Lights, continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next area I'll touch on briefly is demographics, and we are an aging society. We are getting older on average year after year. However, because we age sort of year to year, the actual contribution that aging makes to our overall healthcare spending growth is actually relatively limited year to year. That's what this chart sort of shows, which is how fast personal health, this is national data, but it would be a similar picture for Minnesota, how fast personal healthcare spending is growing and what portion of that growth is really due to the aging. And aging is that very small light blue bar, the darker blue bar being overall growth. Other factors really tend to swamp overall healthcare spending. However, as our population does continue to age over the course of the next 20 years, and as the baby boom generation moves from, what this shows is hospitalization rates by age, and you see that the baby boomers are between 35 and 54 right now, as that group moves through the system and moves into the higher use years, up in the 65 to 74 and 75 plus, aging will begin to have a fairly significant impact on our healthcare spending. Much of that will be paid for by the Medicare program, but at the federal level, but it will still have a fairly significant impact over the next 20 years, which might have some impacts on things such as hospital capacity and other things here in Minnesota. And then I'll close, Mr. Chairman, real briefly by talking about public health insurance programs in context. And I know Mr. Osborne is going to be talking more specifically about the programs, and I just wanted to touch on a few things.
We've got one question here. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You didn't do the other factors, and that was where I had a question for you. One of the most eye-opening things for me in healthcare costs is when we were looking at the Riverside Coal-Fired Power Plant in Minneapolis, and we were looking at converting it to gas, and we got the health care costs for that facility. It's an old facility, doesn't have scrubbers. And just for the health care costs for fine particulate matter was $56 million a year from that one plant. And then the total costs were about $100 million a year. So we're paying those costs. But now we're seeing the fine particulate matter in the metropolitan area going over the safe levels or whatever, even at levels considered safe, they were imposing huge health care costs, and I think Representative Sikora mentioned asthma, and asthma is one of them. Have you all made a determination of what fine particulate matter in the metropolitan area costs us?
Mr. Lights,
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my group has not. I'm not aware that there are figures out there, but there may be, and I'm just not aware of them. I don't. It's not an area that I've done a lot of work in, so it's very possible that there is. I'm just not familiar with it.
Representative Guinness.
I think it was from your alma mater, Mr. Chairman, that there have been some major studies that have been peer reviewed and set nationally what the cost of fine particulate matter is on communities, and it was those figures that were used to determine what the Riverside plant and Highbridge and other coal-fired power plants were costing us. And it seems to me that if we don't get a handle on those costs, particularly when you're looking at something like asthma, now asthma is being associated with autism, which is rising like this, that we need to get a handle on some of these costs that are being imposed upon us. Does the health department have a way to start looking at that issue?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'd certainly be happy to go back and talk with the department, with my colleagues there about that issue. It's not an area that my particular group has done a lot of work in, but I could certainly be happy to circle back with the department and see if there's any information we can provide to the committee on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That would be helpful.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chairman, members, this chart really illustrates one of the points that I think was brought up earlier around how our private health insurance system tends to be the driver of our relatively low levels of uninsurance. What it shows at the top black piece is the uninsurance rate, and I'm comparing Minnesota to the rest of the U.S. here, and shows that we have a rate that's approximately a third of what the rate is nationally. And really what it demonstrates is that that's primarily driven by a much stronger
private sector health insurance coverage here in Minnesota, around 70% of our population compared to 60% nationally. And actually, our enrollment in public health insurance programs in Minnesota is pretty comparable to what we see nationally. It's about the same portion of our population that's enrolled in medical assistance or the Medicare program as nationally.
Now, Mr. Leitz, that surprises me because everyone has medical assistance, but other states don't have Minnesota care in most cases, or an equivalent or general assistance medical care. Why is it that we've got the same proportion of as other states when we've got so many more programs that other states don't have?
Mr. Chairman, it's primarily driven by income differences that exist between states. So while we have programs in place and oftentimes at eligibility levels that differ from other states, occasionally higher, the fact that the per capita income, the average income in Minnesota, is relatively higher than it is in other states with lower incomes, there are more people in those states who are eligible for the programs in those states, even if eligibility levels in those states are actually lower than in Minnesota, because their income levels in general are lower.
Okay. All right. Please continue.
Contextually, I know that you're going to be hearing a lot about that.
Representative Rucavina.
You know, I think it'd be remiss on my part, at least, to point out the fact that, if we took out Minnesota care, we'd be a lot lower than that figure even. And Minnesota care is a program where people pay a premium based on their income. So, in a sense, I don't see why we're calling it a public program, because people pay a premium for those that can't either get on other kind of insurance or can't afford other kind of insurance, and I think it's actually to our credit to this state that we're below the national average, and we're including Minnesota care in there.
Well, of course, Representative Rook, Minnesota care is subsidized by the state. If I remember right, I think it's two-thirds paid for by the state and one-third by the premiums, but Representative Bradley would probably correct me on that.
Mr. Chair, I'll correct you on that.
All right.
And using Representative Gunther's philosophy, the state isn't paying that two-thirds. We as consumers are. And like Ms. Prinky's, for the Chiba. Oh, Jesus. You know, her hospital association is paying it, and we as consumers are paying it, and certain times when we go to, private pay people are paying it when they purchase their own insurance. Our employers are paying it. The state isn't paying it. We pay it into the state. And it's been rifled recently, that whole fund, I might add, but that's a whole other issue. But it isn't the state paying that. It's all of us Minnesotans. It's a tax on us for those people then to come that can't get health insurance for whatever reason through their employer and pay a premium, so they're paying it too. I don't know what percentage is paid in the premium part of it, but you said one-third. I suppose you're probably right on that. But the fact of the matter is, just so we aren't misleading anyone here, is the state isn't putting that money in. It's not coming out of general fund. It's a tax on all of us here as consumers.
Well, I mean, clearly all money that comes into the state ultimately comes from someone. But I won't get into a debate with you on it, Representative Rucavina. Representative Solberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification on this particular chart. Is Minnesota care counted as the insurance, or is it counted as the public?
Mr. Leitz. Mr. Chair, Representative, it'd be counted as part of the public piece.
And so, in effect, Mr. Chair, if one-third of that is paid by premiums, could we then take at least and shift some of that down into the insurance? Would that be fair to say?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, what this really tried to tease out is just by primary source of coverage.
Okay.
So,
I understand. Okay.
And I may well be wrong about that one-third. Representative Bradley, maybe you can correct me or affirm what I said. Or you have some other comment, perhaps.
Just a couple of comments. First of all, on the subject of the difference that Minnesota care makes, I think we should put it in perspective. If you take that one bar chart with the stacked bar chart, 3% is all that Minnesota actually covers in terms of percent of the population. That would bring us up around 8%. We still would be half the national average. So we really need to give credit in Minnesota largely to the private sector, which I think is the message that Mr. Leitz is making, is that our position is more driven by the generosity and culture or whatever been the reason in Minnesota of having largely employers offer insurance. That's one. Two, on the point you make, and I don't remember the exact number, but I suspect it's far, far lower, because if you look at the distribution of people on MinnesotaCare, the highest concentrations are relatively low-income people who give very small premiums, and many are getting the minimum of $4 a month. I doubt that it's higher than 15-20%. Plus, in most of MinnesotaCare, at least with families, we're getting federal match through our waivers. So there's even a component of federal dollars. I mean, still taxpayer dollars. This is all, I mean, all comes from us and our constituents in the end, really. But a fair share of it, maybe upwards of a third of the total dollars that are spent in MinnesotaCare come because of our waivers through federal tax dollars.
Okay. Representative Otremba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we have to remember that these are working people that are not offered health insurance from their employee. So that's a big difference between welfare and the working person whose company says that they can't give them insurance, so that then the pool of money, the Health Care Access Fund, was specifically developed to pay those bills.
Okay, I'm going to call on Representative Solberg, and then I really want to get cracking on this presentation so we've got time for the other testifiers. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, both Representative Gunther shared with me an iPhone on the Internet that, from Massachusetts, and Gunther's was from Tennessee. The amount of cost that was shifted to the public for employers such as in Massachusetts, it was Walmart, Stop and Shop, and another Dunkin' Donuts, I think, the shift of two of them. Do we have any kind of statistics in Minnesota how many people who are what I would say successful companies? I don't want to pick on Walmart, but I can pick on any successful company that has shifted their responsibility to the public that I would say is at least somewhat of a corporate responsibility to provide health care. Do we have anything of that that we found on Tennessee Care and Massachusetts Care?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not familiar with any specific work on that. I think we generally know a little bit about the employer market. I mean, employers are far more likely to offer coverage, for example, the larger those employers are. But it also varies a lot by the amount of hours that workers work, as well as the wages that workers earn. High wage firms, for example, are far more likely to offer health insurance coverage than low wage firms. But I don't have anything on specifics such as your.
Mr. Chairman, those are interesting statistics, and they're available both from Representative Gunther and myself.
Okay. All right, Mr. Lights, let's have you finish off your presentation here. I'll try to be brief, Mr. Chair. And really, this is really more contextual for the coming presentations. What I really wanted to show, the first slide just shows, this is national data, what portion of the average state's budget goes for health care services as broadly defined to include Medicaid as well as state employee and public health and other things. And on average, it's about 30% of an average state's budget. Most of that 30%, and that's what this breaks down, really goes primarily for the Medicaid program, not surprisingly. About 70% of an average state's health care spending goes for Medicaid. But there are other portions that are also important, things such as state employee health benefits, population health, and community-based services. In Minnesota, and I know that you're having an overview a little bit later on this, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, 27% of the state's general fund budget goes for health and human services. But if we look at all funds, which would include the Health Care Access Fund and other funds, about 38% are devoted for health and human services. And then finally, this point that was brought up a little bit earlier, that enrollment and spending in the medical assistance program really is disproportionate. Most of the people enrolled, about around 70%, in medical assistance are families with children, and only about 30% is elderly and disabled and the blind. But those portions of the population that enroll about 30% spend almost over 75% of our resources in the medical assistance programs. Very expensive, high-cost populations. And those proportionally have grown over the course of the past decade as a portion of our overall medical assistance enrollment. And so, Mr. Chair, in summary, certainly healthcare expenditures have outstripped economic growth over the past several decades. There's a lot of factors that influence
healthcare costs. There are many, and they're interrelated, and some are inside of policy control, and some, such as genetics and technological growth, are really some degree outside of healthcare policy control, policymaker control. And that healthcare cost drivers have really had similar effects on either private or publicly sponsored health insurance coverage. And then I'll just leave you with that final point about most of the health spending being concentrated among a relatively small portion of the population.
And Mr. Leitz, if I can just go back a couple slides to one thing. When you compared, when you said nationally, it's about other states, if you add them all up, are about 30% of their budgets are health care, 70% non-health care. Was that all funds or was that their general funds? I mean, is the proper comparison 30% nationally but 38% in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the answer to that is that it was all funds, but I'm not 100% certain of that.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Mr. Osberg, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Osberg. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'd like to refer you to a document entitled Health and Human Services Budget. We do not have a multimedia show, but I can take you through at least this document. Mr. Chairman, on the first slide, we talk about the Health and Human Services Budget. We're talking about not only Department of Human Services, but other health services in state government. It's primarily Department of Human Services, but it's also Department of Health and other agencies. As you see there, 29% of the projected general fund budget of the next biennium will be going towards health care. Now, if you look at the graph here, we talk about all funds. These are state funds. The forecast in November is projecting an increase of approximately $1.4 billion in our health care services. Now, this is on a base of $7.8 billion. In other words, an 18.5% increase. That's the number the governor has been referencing when we talk about increase in health care expenses from this biennium to the next. Now, if you look to the right, under the governor's proposal, the increase would be about 15%. 15.92.
Mr. Chairman, what book are we in now?
We're in this book here that says Health and Human Services Budget on the front.
Right.
And what page are
you? Page, first inside page. Go ahead, Mr. Osberg.
Let me then go to the next page. Or it says Department of Human Services. It's part of human services expenses will be about 28% of the general fund for 06 and 07. Now, when we talk about the Department of Human Services expenses, we talk about all expenses, including our regional treatment centers, meaning our state hospitals, our administrative costs, grants associated for our nonprofit organizations, and our health care programs. So this is all of our budgets, if you will, in the Department of Human Services. And the base, the 0405 base for state funds only is $7.6 billion. You can multiply that roughly by two in terms of getting the total dollars because that includes the federal expenses. So on a base of $7.6 billion, we're forecasting an increase for the next biennium of $1.436 billion. And we're, as I said, the governor's budget, the increase is over 15%. Now, the reason why there's a big change in health care access fund, if you look in the bottom line, is that the governor is proposing the transfer of the expenses associated with the General Assistance Medical Care Program over to the health care access fund. The health care access fund is the fund that is supported by the premium tax and provider tax and by the premiums you're referring to. By the way, in terms of Minnesota care, the premiums paid by citizens or enrollees is 11%. 11% of the Minnesota care expenses are paid by premiums of enrollees, 55% by the state and 35% by the federal government. Just to correct what was said earlier.
Okay, so I'm sorry about that. It is 11% that's paid for by the premiums in Minnesota care.
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you. Representative Silbert.
Chairman, sir, are we able to collect from the federal government the amount of premium tax as well?
that is paid in? If we pay in 11%, if I pay in a buck of my premium, does the federal government match that premium as well? Because it matches the state funds?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Silver, yeah, the federal government shares half of that the premium that's paid, right? So we share that premium with them.
Okay. Representative Rocabina.
Well, yeah, I was looking at these numbers, and I know what the governor's trying to do here, but I'm sitting here thinking about something, and I'm looking at these growth projections. Now, if I recall correctly, the growth in the cottage industry was almost the same, and a lawsuit was brought by I don't know who, but our courts decided that we couldn't put that surcharge or whatever it was on people on legal assistance or legal aid.
No, on public defenders.
Defenders, excuse me. So we had to put that in a deficiency bill.
We found
the money for that. And I'm wondering, because I'm really sitting here, and I wish Mr. Prinky were around here. Is there anybody else from the hospitals here as an example? No, Tom, you're not with them anymore. But I'm thinking, because I'm really thinking how they're really getting hammered here under this proposal, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but the gentleman from the Department of Human Services, but the governor is proposing to cut the hospitals, and the hospitals are paying part of the health care access fund payments, and then they're going to be cut, and then they're going to have to take these people that fall off Minnesota care and serve them for free if they're public hospitals, especially like the Virginia Regional Medical Center. And then on top of that, they got to take the general assistance people who are being thrown into the fund that they're paying in for the working poor, and then they're going to get reimbursed 5% less than last year on these people on general medical assistance. I'm wondering why the Minnesota Hospital Association or the Minnesota Medical Association doesn't sue for some kind of constitutional thing like the healthcare or like the public defenders did, because it seems they've really got a case here, Mr. Chair, that they're just what's being done here is basically against the law.
Well, I guess I can't speak to that, Representative Rooker, but let's. I know we could spend a lot of time the rest of the hour we've got going through the governor's proposal. I really don't want to get much into the governor's proposal today. We'll have plenty of time to do that. I guess I know that the chart here talks about the governor's proposal, and I think, Mr. Osberg, I really would prefer that we focus more just on what's happening to drive the growth and, fact that, it's going to go up 19% if we do nothing and so on and so forth. Let's talk about what is driving that and not focus so much on the governor.
Representative Silver, Mr. Chair, the growth is going to be there 19% no matter what.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of who pays is what we need to have some discussion on at some point.
Well, we need to have a discussion about who's going to pay, but we also, I think, need to have a discussion of why is there 19% growth in the first place. And I guess I just feel we're going to get distracted if we start talking about the governor's plan and how he's talking about cutting the growth and if that's the right way to do it or not. I think we need to first focus on why is it 19% to begin with. Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, then the next slide says Department of Human Services forecasted health care programs. Now, these are our entitlement programs that we have. They include medical assistance, general assistance medical care, Minnesota care, and a prescription drug program. Today, we have approximately 485,000 Minnesotans in medical assistance, 37,000 in general assistance medical care, and about 145,000 in Minnesota care, and about 7,800 in a prescription drug program. Now, these forecasted health care programs they're not appropriation programs, they're forecasted programs, meaning that this is the best estimate that we have in terms of how much it will cost to provide services under these programs. This does not include our regional treatment centers or grants that we provide. It does not include, certainly, our welfare programs. It does include three things. One is long-term care, including nursing home services. Number two is home and community-based services for the elderly and disabled. And three is medical services such as hospitalization, pharmacy, and physician services. And as you see there on the graph, the elderly and disabled account for approximately 23% of our enrollment, or our clients, population and 63% of the expenditures. Now, this includes long-term care expenditures as well as health care expenditures for the elderly. And families and children account for 66% of the enrollment and 24% of the expenditures. And adults without children account for 11% of the enrollment and 13% of the expenditures. Half of our clients, Mr. Chairman, are children. So approximately 50% of our clients are children, 23% are elderly and disabled, and 27% are adults. Now, you can see, Mr. Chairman, the increase that's being forecasted for these programs. It's 24% increase. This is state funds only. 24% increase under the current forecast, November forecast. Now, inflation, by and large, is included in these numbers. There is some inflation in terms of provider reimbursement is not included, but our projected increases to managed care organizations and to expected increase in utilization are included in these forecasted numbers. Now, the base of this increase is $5.7 billion. So we're seeing a significant increase in the next biennium. Mr. Chairman, this now breaks down what's causing this, the next graph. Again, this is for all of our forecasted programs, our entitlement programs. There's two factors in play here. One is enrollment increases, and number two is inflation. And the first column, you can see the increase in enrollment in our programs in terms of the history of that of those increases, plus projected increases going forward. Again, this is based on a November 2004 forecast. Notwithstanding changes that took place in 2003, we're seeing an increase in our programs in the next few years. And the next second column then it gives you the increase annual basis from 2000 to 2007. See about a 5% increase is based on actual and projected in terms of enrollment. The third column is the increase in our payments, in essence, inflation, as to what we're paying for these services. And there's two factors within inflation. One is the provider unit price, how much we pay physicians and hospitals and managed care organizations. The second is utilization. Those two factors drive then this monthly average payment increase. So if you look in the bottom row, you'll see, as projected from year 2000 to 2007, a 9.7% increase, annual increase. Now, so when you do a biennium to biennium, the numbers are big. We break it down year to year, numbers are still big, bigger than inflation certainly. 9.76% is certainly bigger, higher than our inflation rate. And that's, therein lies our problem that we're facing. So the issue is that we have both enrollment increases and inflation. And by and large, it's 50-50 in terms of influence of these two factors.
Mr. Osberg, why did the annual percent change go up so much more the last few years as compared to what you're forecasting for the coming 3 years? Why are you projecting it's going to go down so much in terms of the rate of increase?
Mr. Chairman, a couple things. One is that the 03 changes affected mostly the next couple of years in terms of projected enrollment. The 03 changes in terms of reduction in eligibility. But also, we are seeing some, and our economist is not here today, George Hoffman, who provides the forecasting and the underlying assumptions. But I think we're seeing a moderation in that growth the next 3 years. If you look at from 2004 to 2007, both the growth in enrollment and growth in inflation is moderating. That is based on some economic and healthcare inflation models within our forecast.
And Mr. Osberg, do the forecasts for 05, 06, and 07 assume the passage of the governor's current proposal, or is this what you're assuming as a baseline projection?
Mr. Chairman, it's the latter. It's a baseline projection. It's not assume any changes based on the governor's proposal or any other changes.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, that was my question.
Okay, thank you.
But Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
To that point, I think the baseline is included after you took in 03, you took, or 02, whenever 03, you took 35,000 people off the system.
right?
This is current law as it exists now then.
Yeah, right, but in 03 you took 35,000 people off the system, so you're going to slow the growth rate down when you take, I don't know what percentage of the Minnesota care population that was, but if you take them off the system, of course you're going to slow down the growth. Nobody qualifies anymore.
Just trying to understand what the assumptions are, Representative Ruccadino.
Well, Mr. Chair, where I come from, that's a pretty obvious assumption. When you don't let a bunch of people work on a program, the program's not going to be as costly. Even a ranger can figure that one out, Representative Earhart.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at the risk of discussing the whole Human Services policy meet here, it would be useful for the committee to understand the 38,000 people that were cut was actually a forecast over 4 years, and actually the man at the table can explain that if you want to know the detail about how many actually left, and because it was a four-year projection. And as these are also projections, so maybe Mr. Osberg, you just comment about that so we can all at least discuss the same array of...
And I guess I didn't hope to get into a political debate here. I think that, as I understand it, many of the 38,000 that were cut were people that actually were cut once we went to a six-month eligibility as opposed to a one-year check and some other factors. But Representative Bradley, did you have some other comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. And then I would just ask members to look at the column that's called Monthly Average Eligibles, and you will see that, in fact, there's a growth year-to-year in every one of those years.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Ruffino.
Chair, last time I checked, I was at the state capitol and not at the state cathedral. I mean, we are politicians. Of course, we're going to get... talk about politics here at this table, because this presentation is about politics. I mean, the whole presentation is politics. And I don't know how you can keep politics out of the state capitol. That's what we get elected to do.
Well, Representative Ruccadino, I don't think the whole presentation is politics, and we're going to have plenty of time for politics. Right now, I am just trying to get some testimony as to the baseline of what's happening, and we'll talk more about politics in the future.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Abler is right. If this gentleman here could tell us how many people are off the system now, or got off the system, or projected to be off the system, maybe we know what we're talking about.
Fair question. Mr. Osberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. In 2003, there was a projection based on the changes that 36,000 fewer people would be enrolled in our program over the next 4 years. Approximately 11,000 people were disenrolled from our programs in 2003 because of the changes. But what the projection that fewer people over time would not be enrolled in our programs because of the changes. And approximately over 10,000 of those people were impacted because we're doing more frequent eligibility determinations, and also that we no longer provided for a grace period after they exceeded their income standard. So we can break down those numbers specifically, but approximately 11,500 people actually lost coverage lost health care program coverage because of the changes in 2003.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ruccadino.
Sir, that was in 2003. Did that gradually increase? We're in 2000. We've gone through 2004 now. Did it double to 22,000?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruccadino, as I said, over time, over the next three, but back then, it was about 4 years, in the next 2 years, 36,000 fewer people would be eligible for our programs based on the changes that were made in 2003. But at the time, in terms of people who actually lost coverage from our programs, it was 11,500 approximately.
But Mr. Chair, that's what I'm trying to get at here.
Sure. Representative Ruffino.
It's 2004 has ended. Don't you have a number for us that how many more above the 10,000 or 11,000 dropped off in 2004?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruccadino.
2003?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruccadino, no, those are people who are not actually on our programs yet. They would have been eligible for our programs over a period of time, but they're not on the program. They were not on the program today because they're not eligible for the program, so they're not disenrolled if they're not on the program.
You cut people off, but you slowed down the growth.
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, the growth has slowed down, as you pointed out, Mr. Ruccadino, but we have still an increase in our program enrollment, as Representative Bradley pointed out, over the next few years, higher than we expected. Reasons stated in part, because of the health care cost increases, the private sector is having a difficult time providing coverage. There are more and more people eligible for our programs.
Okay, well, let's, unless someone has another burning question here, Representative Geiling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not so much a burning question as a burning comment. I don't think it's politics when we're just trying to get facts. And the facts are that some people are disenrolled, and even twice as many are not eligible who would have been eligible. So I don't know that we need to shoot the messenger, Mr. Osberg, who's just giving us the facts, but I would say that we could look to ourselves, you know, loosely speaking, those of us here who voted to make those cuts, and now we're finding out that money's being saved. So I'm not a ranger, but even I can also figure this out. And I don't think it's politics, though. I think it's facts, and pretty sad facts at that.
Well, Representative Greiland, I guess I don't think I said that that was politics. I guess what I'm trying to avoid is a full-ranging discussion of the governor's future proposal. I think current law, what we've got here, and what we've done in the past, and how it's affected things, certainly that is appropriate. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A short comment or question.
Yeah, no, it's a question. Assistant Commissioner Osberg, this weekend I happened to review with my son and his landscape company's group health insurance. They just have a small company, probably a dozen people or so covered under the plan, and it was a 3.66% increase in the coming year in his group health insurance. And wouldn't that kind of be consistent? Isn't your number like a 3.3? So when we're really comparing apples with apples, we've really slowed this down. I believe 2 years ago, our increase at the company when I was still the owner was about 15%. So I'm getting a little lost in all the discussion about the Minnesota Care and everything. Is what you're really saying is that we've made some real headway in the actual growth rate that I saw at our landscape company really has slowed down. Is that what this graph is trying to show, or table, as Representative Earhart has referred to it?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, yes, I'm suggesting that over that 7-year period of time, 4.38% increase over that period of time in terms of inflation increase is not bad compared to what's happening in the private market. The point I want to make here is that half of our increase is because of enrollment. The other half is because of inflation. That's the key point I'm trying to make here, and that it's not as bad as it sounds. It's still, the increase is still exceeding general inflation, so we still have a problem over time, but it's not as bad as it appears in terms of other data.
Okay, members, we're clearly going to go beyond our normal 2:15 cutoff. I'm not planning on coming back at the after session today. I am expecting we're going to go, unless this goes much more quickly, till 10:02 or something like that. But I've got three more people that want to speak, Representatives Secora, Huntley, and Mariani. But I'd also really like to get on with Mr. Osberg. I mean, do all of you really feel you have to say something? Representative Secora passes. Thank you. Representative Mariani. Go ahead.
Sure, sir, and you can answer this later, right now. Where can I go, if anywhere, in the state of Minnesota where the Department of Human Services can show me in their budgets what the universal impacts of the state of Minnesota are in regards to our health care costs, given the fact that in 2003 we disenrolled 11,500 people? Does such a study exist anymore? I understand we're focused just on the budget, as we should be, but as politicians, we're also concerned with the overall impact in the state of Minnesota health care costs, and they're clearly not all being captured within this document. So, and maybe we could talk later, but the question is, where do I go to get a handle on the state of Minnesota in terms of whether things are good or bad in terms of health care costs?
Mr. Osberg, if you could provide some information like that to Representative Mariani after this meeting or maybe another time, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Chairman, we'll do that.
Okay.
With the health department's help, we will sit down and do that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Huntley, do you have a question?
Chair, just a comment to Representative McNamara's. We can cut 11,000 people or 36,000, whatever the number is, off of our public programs and make our budget look good. The problem is they don't go away, and they still show up at the hospitals. They still get sick. They still get treated. And if you want to know what happened in 2004 because of what we did in 2003, the uncompensated care costs of our hospitals went up 20% to 30%. And guess what the hospital does when it has that increased deficit? it raises the rates to the other payers. And so part of the premium increases you're going to see are because we cut these people off of our programs.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, actually, Representative Huntley just said what I was going to ask Mr. Osberg to quantify, which is, could you quantify when you're looking at that, Representative Mariani's request, where those costs were shifted to? Actually, give us the figures there, and I think Representative Huntley gave you a blueprint of where we go looking.
Okay, we'll let Mr. Osberg work on that. Back to you, Mr. Osberg. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide. No. As I said earlier, there's three categories in our budget. One is long-term care, meaning nursing homes. Number two is home and community-based services for the elderly and disabled. And the third is the basic health care programs. This slide says Minnesota public health care programs is for our basic services, meaning hospitalization, pharmacy, dental, physician services. If you go right to the bottom line in terms of an increase, remember, is enrollment is the first or the second column, 5.15% enrollment increase and 6.03% annual increase for basic health services, totaling 11.49. And as we indicate here, we expect that to moderate over the next 3 years based on the forecast of our economists. Now, what's driving this? What's driving these increases in terms of the inflation side? Is the same thing that's driving overall healthcare costs, same things that Mr. Leitz covered. That is increased technology, increased, of course, development and introduction of drugs, demographics. What we're seeing, by and large, we're seeing the same thing that the private sector is seeing in terms of causes of increases in our healthcare costs. That's why we have partnered with the private sector through the Smart Buy Alliance to try to determine whether or not we can affect those increases over time. So I'll give you an example. Our fee-for-service expenses, for example, for the disabled population, 35% of our expenses are for drugs. 35% are for drugs. So that's the big issue that we're trying to manage now is ongoing pharmaceutical costs. We also contract with managed care organizations for two-thirds of our population, and we need to negotiate actuarially sound rates with those, or based on federal law. And the average that we're forecasting is about 7.5% over the next few years. So that is what we're facing at this point is those kind of increases. Again, the same thing that's driving increases in the private sector is driving increases in our programs.
Mr. Osberg, if I can ask on this chart, though, I mean, if medical assistance, basic care for families is, this is hospitals and physician office visits, dentists, I mean, it looks like the inflation rate for the services themselves are going up fairly steadily. I thought that a lot of this was somewhat frozen by the state in terms of our basic reimbursement rate for a hospital procedure, for example. Is that not the case?
Mr. Chairman, no, it's not entirely the case. That had some impact, certainly. That moderated some of these numbers. But we continue to negotiate with managed care organizations based on the utilization increases as well as provider increases. As I said before, inflation is made up of those two factors. And so you're seeing utilization go up. Even though provider reimbursement may not have gone up as much, that's what's driving the 6.03% number more than anything is the utilization of services that are provided to our clients.
But the monthly average payments are going up substantially too.
Mr. Chairman, that average monthly payment is both provider payment as well as utilization, not just provider payment. That's right. What you need to keep in mind.
Okay. Representative Rukvina.
Mr. Chair, are we on the page the title is Minnesota Public Health Care Programs?
Right, mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Mr. Osberg, I don't understand what this means here. If you look at the bottom line there, the average annual growth from 2000 to 2007, and you've got an eligibility change of 5.15%, meaning that's how many new people increased, right?
Chairman, that's right.
And mm-hmm. then you've got a 6.03%, meaning that's how much the actual dollar amount increase for the state, right?
Mr. Chairman, no, that's the actual payment per person, the increase per person, not full dollar, no.
I didn't understand what that was.
Right.
I was wondering how that added up.
Mr. Chairman, you take the two together and it adds up. You take enrollment increases and inflation increases and that adds up to your 11.4 number.
An individual increase there.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's probably, it needs to be made clear, right? It says that monthly average payments needs to, as per person, Mr. Chairman.
But then, I guess that gets back to my question, Mr. Osberg. And if that's per person, then that implies that there is a fair amount of inflation in these costs in general, that we're not freezing hospital reimbursements, we're not freezing physician reimbursements. I mean, this is actual inflation in the amount we pay per procedure.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If I remember right, our actual increases in the provider price side, the provider payment side, is a couple percentage points only. And then most of this increase is due to utilization, increased utilization of services.
So it's increased. It's not necessarily more people. It's each individual utilizing more services.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that's what's generally driving up health care expenses.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't heard you mention anything about physicians being a cost driver here, but on that previous batch of slides on page 6, the mid one shows that 31.9%, that's the high piece of, the next one was 21 point something or other on drugs. Now, and the physicians were the highest mark of cost driver. And I don't know if they're talking about their salaries or utilization or what, but that's almost twice what, half again what any other factor on your health care cost drivers, which you haven't mentioned, and I didn't hear mentioned at the time.
Mr. Chairman, Osberg, we've not increased our payment to physicians under our fee-for-service program for some time. So there's not been any contribution to this problem from that. Certainly, utilization of physician services has gone up. And so if you're referring to what Mr. Leitz presented in terms of changes, yeah, that's in the population in general. And it's less so probably in the case of our programs. Now, the managed care organizations that we contract may have increased their payments to physicians during this period of time. That is their discretion. Though it's somewhat tied to our fee schedule.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Strasburg, is there any place here where you're recognizing or breaking out administrative costs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, no, this does not include our administrative costs. It does include administrative costs of the managed care organizations that we contract with.
Thank you. Is that pointed out here somewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we can get that number for you.
Thank you.
All right, please proceed, Mr. Osberg.
The last few slides, just break this down by category of population. So again, this is referring to the last row, in right bottom corner numbers. You can get an idea as to the increase per year, an average increase per year for medical assistance care for families. This is families and children in a medical assistance program. Next is elderly and disabled. And then this excludes, again, remember, this excludes our nursing home and our home and community-based services, which we're going to talk on in a minute. This is just for basic health services. And then the next one is general assistance medical care, which is the largest increase. If you look in the right-hand corner, 16.82% increase over a seven-year period of time for two major reasons. One is that we're seeing an increase in, well, you see the numbers, you see primarily an increase in enrollment, 12.39%. We're seeing a significant increase in enrollment because some of the people in Minnesota care are eligible for general assistance medical care, but also we're just seeing more than forecasted number of people enroll in this program. And then the Minnesota Care graph is the last one I'm going to, or one of the last ones I'm going to look at and go over. Again, there is a shift from Minnesota Care over to medical assistance in terms of enrollment. That's what's causing these negative numbers, negative 1.97%. But you're still seeing inflation in terms of the 12.84% inflation still occur. That's in part because of catch-up. We frankly underpaid managed care organizations early on for the services they were providing, and which is now starting to catch up. But over time, over the next 3 years, we expect that to moderate as well. And Mr. Chairman, the last graph I'm going to cover, then I'm going to refer to our continuing care people, is a Medicare is prescription drug program, where we have 7,700 individuals, and you see the numbers expected to drop. This is because of the enactment of the Medicare Part D program, where Medicare is going to provide drug coverage to these people. These people are low-income Medicare beneficiaries, and these people will have coverage under the new federal program. And in fact, our proposal, budget proposal, suggests the elimination of this program because of that. Mr. Chair, I'd like to then ask the Sue Bankin from our Continuing Care Administration to come up to go over the long-term care costs going forward, including nursing home costs.
Ms. Bankin, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Sue Bankin, and I'm from the Continuing Care Administration for Department of Human Services, and I'm a budget manager there. I'm here today to tell you about the growth in health care costs for long-term care services for medical assistance-eligible people who are elderly or who have disabilities. Now, continuing care services include a variety of home and community-based options that help people to live more independently in their own homes and communities. And some examples of these services would include home care, nurse visits, homemaking and chore services, home-delivered meals, and caregiver support, just to name a few. These services offer an alternative to nursing home or facility-based care. Now, you may hear me use the term waivered services in this presentation, and waivered services are simply home and community-based services that are provided under the authority of a federal waiver to people who are MA eligible and who are seeking an alternative to a facility-based level of care. If you want to take a look at the last two pages in your handout, I'll go over those with you. The first page deals with long-term care average monthly caseload for elderly and long-term care spending for elderly. And this gives you a picture of the total cost trends there. If you look at the total line, it's the line labeled total, which is the top line on each of the charts. Total spending trended over the next 4 years is 13%, or just over 3% per year. And caseload increases are also trending at just over 3% per year. Now, this is made up of the home and community-based services, as I mentioned before, and also facility-based services. For elderly people, most of those services, all of those services essentially are performed in nursing homes. And long-term care utilization in nursing homes is actually declining, both in terms of caseload and in terms of actual expenditures. One note about the expenditure figures on this chart is these are total state and federal dollars, so the general fund state costs are roughly half of what you see here. Waiver
Ms. Bankin, let me ask about the waivers a little bit. If we didn't go to the federal government and get the waivers, what would happen to these people? Would they be in more institutional settings? Would it be more or less expensive? What would happen?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would be more expensive. If we didn't have the waivered services as an alternative, there would be more people in nursing facilities today. It is a more expensive cost to provide those services in an institutional setting. With waivered services, it's a package of services available for individuals, and they can receive the care they need, but not necessarily take the whole package of services, just what's needed to be able to remain in their own homes and communities.
And do we get the same match from the federal government for those services as we do with medical assistance?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Please continue.
If you look at the trend for waiver and home care, both in terms of caseload growth and in expenditures, those are increasing over the next 4 years. And those increases essentially are being offset by some of the decreases of people who are no longer living in nursing facilities. So that brings you to the general trend line in total of the 3% or thereabouts per year of the next 4 years. So what are these charts telling us? Well, first of all, they're indicating that while the caseload is growing, the overall costs are being managed through use of the less expensive home and community-based services, and we're seeing less use of nursing homes. The number of nursing homes in the state is actually decreasing. There are 402 licensed and certified nursing homes in the state today, as compared to 440 back in 1987. And there are a growing number of providers who offer home and community-based services to individuals, and that includes in-home care and assisted living. And as a result of these trends, the ratio of elderly people served in nursing homes is shifting from about 50-50 today to about a 60-40 ratio in 2009, when about 60% of the people will be in home and community-based services. So as we look to the future, there are four cost drivers and pressures that I want to mention that pertain to elderly people. The first one is the increasing number of elderly, especially people over age 85, who will need publicly funded long-term care. The rate of growth is increasing presently in the number of people 85 and over who are the people most likely to use these services, but that's projected to increase very rapidly after we pass the year 2020. Between the year 2000 and 2050, the number of people age 85 and over is expected to triple from what we have today. The second driver is the increasing cost of providing long-term care services, and this includes the cost of retaining our long-term care workers and the cost of operating the programs. A third driver is the continued reduction in the number of family members who are available to provide full-time care to their elderly family members. Families today are not as big as they were a number of years ago. There are fewer people available, adult children, to take care of the elderly person, and it's falling more and more upon paid employees to provide that service as the family members are simply not available or they themselves are in the workforce. And the fourth driver is the growing number of elderly whose income is not adequate to pay for their long-term care costs into the future. DHS has been doing some research on this, and it's very concerning the rate of savings that isn't occurring with the baby boom generation. If people aren't planning for their own retirement and eventual long-term care needs, we could have quite a surprise in the next 10 or 20 years. The final chart, then, is on the last page, the average monthly caseload growth and long-term care spending for people with disabilities. And looking at the total line here, we're seeing a trend in caseload of about 8% growth per year for people with disabilities accessing these programs, and a trend of about 8.1% per year in expenditures. Looking at the dark black line that indicates the facility-based services for disabled people, this is primarily ICFMR care for people with developmental disabilities and use of nursing homes for people who are under the age of 65 but who have disabilities. And we're seeing a decline in both caseload and real expenditures in both those areas. The increases are occurring again in waiver and home care utilization. Those costs are trending at a rate of about 10.2% per year for the next 4 years. However, 40% of those payments are related to movement from institutional settings and shifts from people who are using other programs shifting to waivered services and home care.
Ms. Bankin?
Yes.
Why? I mean, as I look at the long-term care number, I can see that growing, and it's actually not growing all that quickly, but here we are seeing some really big increases. Why are we having such a large increase in the number of, in the caseload for disabled? I mean, I can't imagine that there are that many more people that are having a traumatic event each year? I mean, is it a case where there are just that many people that don't have someone to care for them anymore, that now the state needs to take care for them? Or talk a little bit more about what's driving the caseload growth.
Well, there are, Mr. Chair, there are a number of drivers in this area. One is the increasing need for home and community-based services for people who are needing 24-hour care. And, yes, you're correct, there are some people who are receiving care from aging parents, and those parents can no longer provide that care. When we're talking long-term care for people with long-standing disabilities, this is oftentimes a lifelong need for individuals, and our population is growing. So there are a number of factors that contribute to this. A second reason why we're seeing a trend here, though, is caseload increases based on lifting up some caps that are currently in place. For three of our waivered service programs. 2 years ago, there were some limits put in place for these programs, and those are set to expire at the end of this year. And so you're seeing a trend of the rebound of people coming back in over the next couple of years to access services who have been waiting. And those individuals have been able to access medical assistance through basic state plan services but have not been able to access the full benefits under waivered services.
And Ms. Bankin, leaving that out, I mean, if you just look at the number of people who would be eligible, leaving aside the issue of the artificial caps, I mean, you know, we've got a 7.5% a year increase, it looks like, roughly, for this population. Yet, I mean, the state's population is only growing maybe 1% a year or 2% a year at most. And why the difference?
Well, Mr. Chair, part of it, too, is that not everybody who's eligible is necessarily accessing these services. If you think back several years ago to when the open enrollment occurred in the MRRC waiver, they anticipated like 500 people may come on to the program, and many more people came on to the program, somewhere around the neighborhood of 5,000 people. Came on, and so it's difficult to tell how many people are out there and when they, you know, when they choose to access the services. In the MRRC waiver, the enrollment is managed in that program, and so the growth is controlled. But there are a number of people out there in need of services, and that number is increasing.
And the waiver cost, is the waiver cost less than the long-term care facility cost?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
Okay. Okay, please continue.
A couple other pressures I'd like to mention on the system is the increased requests from families who need long-term care services for their disabled children. Secondly is the increasing cost, again, of providing long-term care services, the costs of paying and retaining long-term care workers in the system. And finally is managing the consumer expectations and balancing this with the state's need to manage costs and to account for quality of services and to assure equitable access to services. It's rather a balancing act that you all do to bring in line these different pressures and needs and services to meet the needs of people in the state.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions?
I guess not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who's next?
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee, Michelle.
And members of the committee. As I'm battling
when I'm batting cleanup here, I'm not battling anything. I'm trying to realign my presentation with the idea that I don't want to repeat myself at all. And first of all, you all have a document like this, and you also have another summary kind of document that looks like this. Okay? This smaller document actually is what you would find in Money Matters that will be posted sometime in the near future. It discusses the governor's recommendations as it relates to forecasts and current law. So I will leave that off to the side. It doesn't sound like your discussion today is really taking a look at governor's recommendations at this time. What is helpful is the legal size paper that is attached to that document, and wow, that really looks small. What I will point out is this. There have been many figures that have been presented in a number of different forms. You hear the governor talk about changes in forecast, changes in spending, changes in what they plan as a budget recommendation. And it depends on the forum that it is presented. The governor will say one set of numbers. The commissioner of health and human services will give you another set of numbers. Our committee will look at even another set of numbers. What I've tried to do in this presentation is take current budget numbers and give you at least an alignment with certain percentages of increase. So in the top one-third of this document, you have a spending summary by agency, all funds. In the middle portion of this document, you have a spending summary, general fund by agency. And then at the very bottom third, you have a presentation of spending in other funds. I would just have this at a point of reference. I'm not going to sit here and go over anything in detail. I will point out in your middle section at the very bottom where it says general fund total, you'll see a 23.2% increase in the change from the 04-05 biennium to the base budget 06-07, and you've seen that in the governor's presentations. And then most recently as well, governor's rec is coming in at about 12.1%. So use this as a point of reference for further discussion, and just remember that everyone has a perspective in which they're giving you numbers, and you just have to be kind of careful on which set of numbers have which percentages of growth and change.
And just to be clear, Ms. Scholl, when I'm looking at, say, the General Fund Department of Human Services, I see Health and Jobs Committee accounts. Does that include the state hospital and sex offender costs?
Yes, it does. It also, and for this presentation in particular, it was easier to do DHS as an entire agency. So I have in this presentation part of Representative Gunther's responsibility as well as the rest of DHS. So this presentation will look even a little bit different than what the Health Policy and Finance Committee will look at.
All right.
So that's one point. And set those documents aside. I am not going through this 24-page presentation, mostly because it would just reiterate everything else that you have heard today. What I will do is this, about halfway through the presentation, and this is really a focus on medical assistance. Mr. Osberg, Mr. Light, and others have talked about increases in healthcare spending. So the one that I'm going to help you work through is about, it's page 13 if you wanted to count down numbers of pages. But it looks like this. What I have done is out of 70 pages of data that is prepared each time we do a forecast by the Department of Human Services, I've taken their historical information and their assumptions for the upcoming biennium and even the planning years and put them in a graphic form. And to me, pictures say 1,000 words. on what is going on, especially when you have significant increases in spending. So what I did is I took the two major parts of the budget that you can see in DHS spending, and it has to do with medical assistance, broke that into the health care components of medical assistance, and then the second chart I will refer to in just a moment is the facilities and home-based care kind of portion. So think of one as the medical insurance part. Think of this, the next one that will be coming as the housing and nursing facility and alternative care kind of components. The important part to look in this graph is this. Right in the center, we're at 05, and I made my own line. I didn't make the line on your page, but this is important because the overall sense is we're seeing growth of MA for both elderly and families and children going at a significant increase like this. And what this does is it highlights where we will have increased spending. And you have the numbers at the bottom of this particular graph to point out exactly how much spending is going on. The next page in your presentation has the continuing care portion, which is the nursing facility and waiver side. And the top two components here and here are doing the same thing. Obviously, the waivers are growing just like the other presentation that I just showed, whereas the long-term care facilities are actually going down a little bit. And so even though we see these changes happening, we want to take a look further underneath of what those changes are doing. And that's what the next set of graphs shows you. We're taking the MA healthcare services portion and took a look at the elderly and disabled. This chart is for the eligible, so these are actually people. And the MFIP family, so the elderly are down here, the MFIP family and children here. And so what you can see is a slight increase with the elderly and disabled portion of the population, and a major increase in spending is anticipated for the MFIP family and children's part. Immediately next door is the monthly average payment per recipient. And what you see is a major increase here going on with the elderly and disabled population in cost, monthly average payment per participant. This little dip here, that's actually a full year, one-time Medicare Part D impact. It has almost a $200 million impact on our budget, but with other factors that are happening, you're seeing this line go up. So even though we'll have a certain cost savings in 07 for that new program at the federal level, it will not. There'll be increases in other places in the budget that will surpass it. So we have.
Excuse me, I got a question from Representative Huntley.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Schill. This chart we're looking at right now, that does not include long-term care, is that correct?
No, this is just for health services.
Thank you.
So we have elderly and disabled over here at a lower number of people, and then we have higher costs going over here. Conversely, we have quite a number of MA family and children, and the cost is still increasing, but it's significantly less than the elderly and disabled population. Now, looking at that even further for the health care costs, These are costs what we spend our money on. It's category of service. You can tell that the MA, infant, family, and children's, most of what we're spending our money and where the cost increases are right here. And what is that? It's managed care HMO components. That will be the part where DHS will be negotiating with their contracts. And Mr. Ausberg pointed out that this is going to be a significant component of how they are able to negotiate HMO contracts in the future for MA, but particularly for families and children. This rate of increase is just tremendous. whereas the MA, elderly, and disabled, their cost increases are also happening in HMO. There's a movement from fee-for-service to HMO. This middle part right here is the shrinking of pharmacy costs, and this part right down here is inpatient, outpatient hospital, which is growing. So you can see a number of different things. The elderly and disabled portion of the population have a number of shifting factors, all still on the growth. And once again, this dip in the chart that you see here is Medicare Part D and the impact. That's where we need, obviously, to spend our time, is where these cost increases are taking place. That's where we need to seek where we can perhaps have cost savings, maybe perhaps through better management, and we'll hear more about that. On the long-term care facility side, which is the next chart, again, what we've got going on here is on the one side you have average monthly recipients. On the other side, you have the payments per recipient. And what you see here is a decrease in the number of recipients that are in long-term care facilities and a large increase in the waivers and home-based care options.
And Michelle, where's that increase coming from? Clearly, it's not all coming from people who are moving out of nursing homes into waivered care.
No, it's in the growth. It's as we have more people seeking services, instead of putting them into long-term care facilities, the growth is happening in the home and community base.
So this is developmentally disabled again, or waiver type services?
Yes. It's also the stratification of different types of care, in, not in a nursing home setting, for elderly people. Anything from assisted living to there's our group home concept, but there's a variety of different kinds of waivers that are happening here.
Okay.
On this side, you can see where the cost is happening. Now, this is kind of goofy. This dip here with respect to long-term care facilities involves something that happened with a state facility and came decertified, and we had to pay for the costs for a two-year period through MA. So you'll see this kind of going up and down, but that's very, it's unusual, but that's what had happened. Whereas, so these costs are along between the $40,000 and $50,000 monthly average payment per recipient. I mean, it's at a very high level, whereas the waivers and home care are significantly more modest. And one of the questions that was asked earlier is, what would happen with these people if they didn't have the waivers or home care options? And my fear is that they would be in some sort of facility that would be at the $40,000 rate instead of somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000 per month. The data bears that out. Looking further into, and I only have two more, looking further into the long-term care facilities, once again, what kinds of facilities are we looking at? We see a decrease in the nursing facilities, and this is the different types of facilities available, whereas the payment for these facilities. We still have the NIDO program. This is the state-operated services program where those that are under the state care, they're usually the more costly, the ones that need the most kind of institutionalized care. And the final chart that we have, and I think this one is most revealing, because everyone seems to want to know what is behind the waiver and home-based care scenario. It's this set of charts that really reveal what's happening in different kinds of waivers. Over here on the recipient side, you have the DD waiver, and this actually was a policy change that allowed entrance into the program, and there's even anticipated growth at a more modest level from the 03 time period moving across here. One thing to watch out for is the CADI waiver, and I believe that that's one of the waivers that they're seeking to monitor incoming eligibility, but that waiver has just boomed over the last several years. The other one that's kind of interesting to watch is the elderly fee for service. What we're doing is watching it come down, because what we've done is moved to an HMO kind of setting, and you can help better manage some of the control, the costs there, instead of having them on fee for service. Monthly payments per recipient on this side of the chart. When we will be watching once again the DD waiver, as well as the TBI waiver, which is another one that appears to have significant growth on the horizon. Those are some of the things that we anticipate to be able to get underneath what is going on with the increases in waivers. Is it a good thing? If you compare the eligibility to the actual cost, it ends up saving money if you have someone using a waiver as opposed to a nursing facility. And this will give you at least an idea of which waivers are more volatile than others. I think that's what I can add to the discussion here. I don't know if there are any questions.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at these numbers, at what point is it actual numbers, and what year does it start as actual forecast?
I'm sorry. Are you referring to a specific chart?
Well,
such as the last one?
Well, I was looking at the projected use of home care versus facilities, but I just wanted to know where this would graph was actual numbers and which was forecast.
This comes from the November 04 forecast, so anything 05 and beyond is a projected number, although for 05 we're pretty much through fiscal 05, so it's going to be closer to reality than some of the 06 and beyond numbers.
And, Mr. Chair, the reason I asked that question is because what we're seeing in the rural areas is about 65% of the people that qualify for home care are refusing it because they're worried that they're going to have a lien placed on their property due to the life estate piece. And then we're starting to see now where they should have had a home care for a couple of years, and they haven't, and so now they're very sick and ending up in the facilities, and so that's why I was asking when these numbers actually became actual and when they were actually projected. So thank you.
All right. Well, Michelle, looks like you've timed your presentation perfectly. It is 10-2. I thank everyone for their patience. You've certainly, all of you, given us a lot of additional material to read. With that, the meeting is adjourned.